Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is producer Lan Lee welcoming you to today's Blue Barrel Conversation distributed through NBN. If you want to catch all of our episodes, you can search for the Blue Barrel Podcast, that's Blue the color, B-E-R-Y-L, or find all of our episodes on piercesalguero.com. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the Blue Barrel, a podcast about Buddhism, Asian medicine, and embodied spirituality. I'm your host, Dr. Pierce Salguero, a professor of Asian studies and health humanities at Penn State's Abington College outside of Philadelphia. Today, I sit down with Justin Stein, a historian of modern Japanese religion and the preeminent historian of Reiki. We discuss Justin's new book about the transnational origins of Reiki called Alternate Currents, and also get into his perspective as both a scholar and a Reiki practitioner. Along the way, we ask what Reiki has to do with Buddhism, what subtle energy feels like up close, and how we can understand the extraordinary experiences that might occur when you open up to the energy of the universe. Remember, if you want to hear more from experts on Buddhism, Asian medicine, and embodied spirituality, subscribe to Blue Barrel for monthly episodes. Please enjoy. Justin, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here. Great to see you too, my friend.
Thanks so much. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
I was trying to remember where we first met, and I feel like you and I have been navigating the same waters for so long that I've actually completely forgotten where that was. Was it?
I think it was in AAR, maybe in Atlanta or something. Oh. But it was a while ago.
Yeah, and I guess you did a translation for edited volume that I put together. That was about 10 years ago, so we've known each other at least that long. And you're involved in all kinds of really interesting research questions that I think we'll have a lot of fun exploring together today. Before we jump in, why don't you just tell our listeners who you are and where you work and what your specialty is, just to get them oriented?
Sure. So my name is Justin Stein. I grew up in New York. I have a kind of long-standing interest in the field of what you might call energy medicine, energy healing, spiritual healing. And I was starting to get into all that stuff around the same time that I also developed an academic interest in Japanese religion. And so over time, for me, Reiki became the practice I ended up focusing on. And so my involvement in Reiki communities grew alongside my kind of academic exploration of the study of Japanese Buddhism and Japanese religion. And now I teach Asian studies at a university in the lower mainland of British Columbia called Kwantlen Polytechnic University, where I have lots of international students. It's an Asian studies classroom where I'm one of the few non-Asian people in the classroom, which is an interesting experience. But at the same time, obviously, I'm providing a different perspective on Asian cultures than my students who grew up in PRC or India would have themselves. And what else are we talking about? My training in religious studies has taught me to have a certain kind of suspicion of how practices develop to maybe bolster certain types of authority in settings of power, how maybe they work with, complicit with dominant systems of, whether it's patriarchy or capitalism, systems of domination. And then at the same time, my Reiki initiation lineage, one of the major, I want to say precepts, or one of the major kind of foundational concepts in practice is of surrender, right? And is of that you should not be trying to do much, that you should be allowing the Reiki to work through you and to be an instrument of Reiki. It's hard sometimes maybe to not be suspicious of that because of my training in religious studies. But at the same time, I think in order to do justice to it as a scholar, there's really this imperative to try it out and see and to immerse myself in that practice and to both be able to have the critical eye and the sympathetic voice, I think, for that practice.
Were you interested in Asian religions, Asian healing practices early on, or how did you first get exposed to some of these ideas that now have become so central for you?
Sure. Yeah. I think one of the major influences is my mom, who is a longtime TM practitioner. I think she started the teacher training in the early 70s and then never finished it. But she's a very enthusiastic TM practitioner, has told me that I really need to get my initiation countless times in my life. And so I think from a pretty early age, I was introduced to the idea of mantra recitation. I believe we listened to some guided meditation tapes when I was probably in kindergarten, first grade, around that time. I also, with my mom, have been basically a lifelong client of a kind of spiritual healer, I think is not a wrong way to describe what she does. So I've definitely been exposed to that from an early age. And then also the children's author, young adult author, Daniel Pinkwater. He has a book called The Last Guru that's for a young adult audience. And I think I read it probably the first time when I was maybe 9 or 10. And it's kind of a parody of guru culture, but at the same time introduces a lot of the kind of Orientalist themes and the themes of, yeah, the guru movements in the US. And so those were things I was exposed to from an elementary school kind of age. Mm-hmm. And then I think around high school time, getting into the Beats, reading Dharma Bums, reading Hermann Hesse, Siddhartha, all of that was influential for me. I did an energy healing course. I was 19 years old. I was going to be 20 later that summer. And someone asked me, hey, have you heard of chakras? And I said, no. And he said, well, my brother is teaching people to open up their chakras and it's pretty awesome. There's this meditation, there's this healing stuff. And I said, wow, that sounds amazing. Then I started doing these meditations and it was really powerful. And I was, when I like put my fingertips on my friend's like back of their head or their spine, really wild things would happen. And I was like very surprised about. And so I was like, okay, there's definitely something going on with these teachings, so that I was interested in going to Asia and learning about Buddhism.
Yeah. And so you headed off on a study abroad trip.
But it's interesting, the program I ended up doing ended up becoming this huge feeder program for Japanese Buddhist grad programs that so many of my colleagues from my generation did that same Antioch Studies program in Japan and ended up getting their PhDs in Japanese religions or Buddhism.
Yeah, so interesting. And of course, the impact that a study abroad has on just opening people's world views and opening people's appreciation for culture and travel and all of that has been something it's a theme that's come up a lot on this podcast, as a matter of fact.
And particularly that Antioch program, it's an experiential education. And so every day you're sitting different types of meditation, like through the program, you're learning different styles, both on the cushion and in the classroom seats. And so you'll be practicing it and then you'll be studying the history and philosophy of the practice as well.
So you've wound up in Japan and got hooked into Japanese Buddhism. Then after graduation, went into Japanese religious studies, Japanese religions. What was your path there?
So I got a Watson Fellowship, which is this incredible experience that is, if anyone's listening from one of the 50 undergraduate institutions that participate in this fellowship program, highly recommend applying for it. It basically allows recent graduates from these different liberal arts institutions, Vanderjahr, where they get to basically just travel around doing whatever it is that they're really interested in. And I wrote a proposal called From Dharma to Dollars, the Commercialization of Quote Unquote Universal Energy. And I was interested in kind of the role that commercial interests had on energy healing practice. And yeah, that was me at 21 writing a grant proposal and getting it. And then at 22, I ended up going to India. That's where I got my first Reiki initiations. And I was in Japan. That's where I ended up doing more research into Japanese new religious movements that did energy work and planted the seeds for what would end up becoming my academic career. After that, I ended up teaching in public schools in New York for a number of years before going back to grad school.
So you really started to take the academic study of these practices much more seriously and really went all in with that. I could have seen in an alternate universe you becoming an energy healer yourself. What was it that drew you to the academic side?
One thing is just that there's so many people out there doing it already, right? To be a professional Reiki healer, it's not an easy path by any means. Like, I think most people in that field are really struggling to pay the bills. And so I do have a lot of respect for people who feel that calling and want to dedicate their lives to healing. And even though I have been told several times, I put my hands on someone, wow, you have a real gift. I always just felt like it really wasn't my calling as much as I've always just loved reading and always dreamed of being a writer. And I like being a teacher. And so doing this kind of scholarly work has always seemed like a calling in a sense. I feel like there's so many other people following that path of healing, and there hasn't been in the history of Reiki enough people maybe asking these types of questions. And yeah, that's what I followed.
Yeah. And as a result, I think of you as the preeminent historian of Reiki in the English language, at least. Maybe there's others in other languages, but you've focused on this for your dissertation. And just recently, your book has come out. So that was in the fall of last year, fall of 2023. Called Alternate Currents, Reiki's Circulation in the 20th Century North Pacific. And that's out with the University of Hawaii Press. And if I'm not mistaken, that's where you have like now crystallized all of the research into one cohesive narrative about the history of Reiki. And I think maybe now might be a good time for us to just maybe first define what Reiki is, but then also just give us a quick little capsule history of the arc of how Reiki goes from being this Buddhist practice in Japan. Why is it now being practiced all over, at least all over North America? How did that happen?
Yeah, great. I want to give a couple of caveats. One is that I couldn't fit all my research into the book, so there is still more to say. But yeah, it definitely is a crystallized look at the development of Reiki, let's say up to 1980, and asking particular questions about that development, where I think there's still lots more to say on the subject. And then the other thing is that Reiki, as you mentioned, you called it like a Buddhist practice in Japan. I think it's Buddhist inflected from the beginning. Buddhism is one of the influences on it. And then we could talk about that definitely in more depth. But yeah, I would hesitate to call it like a Buddhist practice necessarily, especially because I think the founder from the beginning was a little circumspect about labeling it as such, particularly in its like exoteric form, that I think that it's something you learn about more as you get the inner transmissions, the okuden level. It has like an esoteric logic to the pedagogy. And so as you move up in the ranks, I think the Buddhist elements become more apparent to practitioners and certainly would have to Japanese practitioners at that time. But yeah, I think it's always on the outside, at least, been of ambiguous. And I think that's self-consciously by the founder, a move that was made maybe to distance themselves from other new religious movements at the time and things like that.
Yeah, interesting.
You asked for a brief about what Reiki is. So the term Reiki is a Japanese compound. It's been used for a long time in a lot of different contexts. It derives from a Chinese word, Lingqi, which is used often to be like the power of a deity in a particular, for example, in the ceremony that might install a divinity in a particular temple or shrine, it said that the Lingqi is put into that statue or that icon. So the character Rei is literally spirit or mysterious, or at the time in like 1920s Japan, it seems like it was also sometimes used in this meaning of wonderful, in the sense of full of wonder, right? Like that mysterious power like the numinous, I think maybe a good translation as well. But yeah, getting back to the book, the title about the 20th century North Pacific is one of the arguments about Reiki, that it's always already been a transnational practice, that there are influences from Japan, but also practices that were arriving in Japan and being localized for Japanese audiences, particularly practices from the U.S., that where there was very strong laying on of hands movement through mesmeric or magnetic healing, and also practices believing in the power of intention and consciousness to generate health, wealth, well-being, prosperity, longevity through movements like New Thought and Christian Science. And so Reiki came out of this very, I think, transnational milieu in the Japanese spiritual healing of that time, of the early 20th century. In most of Reiki's history, the hands are placed on the body. Today, often they're held a little bit off the body in the aura or the energy fields around the body. And there's the idea that the practitioner, whether they're treating themselves or treating someone else, is connecting to a universal source of power. And that power is only capable of good things, that there is always a beneficial outcome. And sometimes that outcome might be helping someone have an easy death, right? That there is this idea that healing is not curing, right? It's not, it's capable of, you know, removing disease. It's capable of not just physical, but mental unease, making people happier, making people healthier. And Hawaii Otakata would say making you wealthier as well, and creating happy families, creating good relationships, giving you a peaceful heart and longevity, right? All of those kinds of worldly benefits that we know and love. It's said that Reiki is a doorway to achieve all of that. And the practice itself is very simple, right? There is an initiation that is believed to strengthen or establish one's connection with this universal source of Reiki, of healing power. Although at the same time, it's said that everybody naturally has this ability. So it is just deepening our natural capacity to connect with this source. And it gives certain maybe tools that you can use after your initiation to maintain and continue to deepen that connection. And one of them is the hands-on healing practice. There's a self-treatment aspect. You can treat other people. There are also these kind of moral principles called the five precepts or the Reiki ideals. Just very briefly, they are just for today. Do not anger. Do not worry. Be grateful. Do your work well or fulfill your duties and be kind to people. And there are, I think, resonances with some Buddhist teachings in there. There's also resonances with teachings from the New Thought movement or other kinds of metaphysical Christianity. And so a lot of, in my research, the earliest practitioners I was able to speak with were people who learned in the late 1930s, early 1940s in Hawaii, in the Japanese-American community, Jodo Shinshu Buddhists, and many of them saw deep connections between the Reiki ideals, Reiki practice, and their commitments to Amida Buddha or to being devout Buddhists. There are basically two practices that I believe came out of esoteric Buddhist, Japanese esoteric Buddhism, and were incorporated into the characteristic practices of Reiki. One of them is the initiation that I already mentioned. And so in Shingon and also esoteric Tendai practice in Japan, it has been applied much more broadly, even into the initiation of a new emperor or in some Shinto settings as well, maybe in other performing arts, martial arts settings. But there's this initiation practice called Kanjo, which is the Japanese adaptation of a Chinese term that was used to translate Abhisheka from the Sanskrit. And in Kanjo, the practitioner is linked to a Buddha who is going to be basically the source of their power for practice. And often in the Shingon practice, the Kechien Kanjo, the first kind of initiation, the practitioner is linked to Dainichi Nyodai, the great sun Buddha, who is, in a sense, the entire universe, right? The Dharmakaya of the Buddha, the all of the material in the universe is the body of Dainichi Nyōdai. All of the sounds in the universe is the preaching of Dainichi Nyōdai. All of our mental ability and mental capacity and consciousness are part of the consciousness of this Buddha. And so I think the talk of Reiki being like of the universe likely has some influence from esoteric Buddhist teachings about the Dharmakaya. And I recently listened to your interview with Nathan Jishin Michon, and there's a lot of connections with what you all were talking about and the early influences on Reiki. And you mentioned Kaji and this interpenetration of the Buddha and the practitioner, which is at the heart of Kaji. Nathan mentioned in your interview the classic image of the moon being reflected in water, whether it's in a lake or in your teacup, right? But that the light of the Buddha can be held onto, right? And so we can receive these kind of blessings or this power from a cosmic kind of source, and we can allow that to fill us and then to share that with others. And I think that's really at the heart of the philosophy of what the practice of Kaji is in Japan. And I think it's also at the heart of what a lot of Reiki is. And especially, I didn't get into when in my explanation of what Reiki was before, another of the essential aspects of Reiki is that it's taught at different levels. And each level has its own initiation and its own teachings. And so this follows the esoteric logic where with each initiation, one learns new practices that one is not supposed to reveal to the uninitiated. And so this was a question about how much to reveal in my scholarship. I feel what I write about is less than what appears in some other Reiki books. So I think they were like the older siblings that like behaved so badly that now people are like, what you're talking about is not so terrible. So I do just talk about that there are these symbols that one learns in the second degree, and the use of the symbols are enhancing one's practice in different ways and enabling different types of therapy. For example, one of the symbols is for a mental and emotional treatment to treat people's mental health and emotional health. And the symbol is derived from what's called a bunji in Japanese, which is a type of Sanskrit syllable. And that syllable can represent either Amida Buddha or Kanon Bodhisattva, so Amitabha or Avalokiteshvara. And there's a mantra associated with that symbol in some Japanese lineages that very clearly invokes Amida. And so it's my belief that this practice to help people overcome, particularly like bad habits is something they talk about, to like purify your heart and give up your bad habits, is associated with the power of Amida or Amitabha. And I believe that in using this symbol, the practitioner is actually engaged in a form of deity yoga, where they become, in a sense, or manifest Amitabha in this world and are able to use that power or allow Amitabha to work through them in assisting the recipient to overcome these bad habits or, you know, purify their heart.
Nice. Yeah, thank you. So there's a lot that Reiki has in common with, of course, it has things in common with Buddhist ideas more generally. And there's a lot of similar ideas about these subtle energies in the body that are prevalent really in all kinds of different Asian contexts. And so we could say, I think more generally, maybe that Reiki is a particular modern Japanese version of subtle body energy ideas or subtle body energy practices more generally. And if we were to look at it like that, through that more global, more comparative kind of lens, I think of your work as being in dialogue with people who study yoga, people who are studying maybe Tibetan medicine, Chinese medicine, this whole world of subtle body practices more generally. And I'm curious if you can think with us, talk with us a little bit about how scholars have approached that topic more generally, because you as a scholar practitioner obviously have a very different positionality than somebody who's just strictly a scholar approaching that.
In the last couple of years, I've been able to attend a couple of wonderful workshops on the subtle body and on subtle energies. And so I've been exposed to a lot of different approaches to this question, whether looking at things like Kundalini experiences, yogic practitioners, as well as things from the mesmeric traditions developed in Europe and exported to the US, and esoteric Taoist and alchemical approaches, Qigong, self-cultivation. I'm not as exposed to the Tibetan traditions, but I find them very interesting as well. And one of the big questions that's come up from a scholarly perspective is about whether to problematize the different paradigms of whether practitioners and people exploring these aspects of the human experience are discovering landscapes that are universal and can be engaged in comparative work, and that they are dimensions of human experience more broadly, which I think some scholars want to go down that way, or whether subtle bodies and subtle energies are constructed by practice and through practice, and whether there are diverse types of subtle bodies that are possible through visualization, magical manifestations, what have you. There's this kind of like discovery versus construction, I think, question in the field. That's just one, I think, of the really interesting questions that's going on in this kind of comparative work or these kinds of cross-cultural conversations. Is there this kind of subtle landscape, energetic bodies, energetic fields that we can map and chart through looking at different cultural approaches? Or are we just learning like the varieties of subtle experience and how different people do it differently, and what are the impacts of that on their lives? And I don't know if that is exactly what you were getting at, but
yeah, no, that's great. I'm fascinated that you're bringing that out as one of the things that scholars are interested in. And one of the reasons that's maybe a little bit surprising to me, I should back up and say that I'm straddling two fields between religious studies and the history of medicine. And I guess in the Asian medicine communities, I'm aware of a lot of attempts to try to define qi in particular according to scientific or biomedical ontologies, right? Biomagnetic fields and so on and so forth. And people are putting a lot of attention on those questions, you know, the kind of is it real question. But what you're pointing to is whether we're discovering or constructing subtle energies. Both of those positions have already moved past the question of whether or not these are real and are talking about where do they come from.
Well, at the same time, I don't think that even the discovery model doesn't necessarily say that's what the texts say and that's what it is, but that there may be qi as metaphor, right? That there are these kind of like naturalistic ways of understanding qi, not as an energy that can be detected as a form of electromagnetic radiation or as a particle that's going to show up in the CERN accelerator, but rather as a felt aspect of human experience that we don't understand yet on a neurological level or a kind of brain science level. And yet it's something that is going on in our bodies. It is something you can be trained to sense. And maybe it's more like another sense that is not super developed than something that's out there. But either way, that's still a discovery model, right? That it's like something that's hardwired in our bodies and minds and something that can be developed and trained as a capacity to be aware of.
All right. So now let's get into a little bit of the details of the phenomenology, because the way you're talking about it makes me think, I guess I should say in my own experience, you know, I started as a practitioner of Thai medicine, working with massage and body work, and also have been a longtime practitioner of yoga. And so that's mostly where my own personal experience is coming from. I'm not a Chinese medicine practitioner at all. For me, qi wouldn't necessarily be the term I would first use to describe my own experience. But I feel like there are deeply subtle dimensions to the sense of touch or to the felt sense of the body, that if you spend some time cultivating feeling the body very deeply, you know, in like quiet meditation or in some kind of contemplative movement, that you can develop a very subtle sense of the body sensations and feel things that you didn't feel a year ago or two or 5 years ago. So I would say it would be like a refinement of the sense of touch, or the refinement of the body sensations, that would get you down to this very subtle kind of level. In my experience, and I think what Nathan Mishon was also talking about in the Japanese esoteric Buddhist case, there also is another lens onto subtle energies, where he was talking about light being a major factor in the Shingon understanding of energy. And that's more of a, it's more of a visual sensation, right? It's maybe more of a, of having to do with the sense of vision than the sense of touch, more like a visual experience, right? The thumb, he was talking about the light of Dainichi Nyorai, that light was what this Buddha sent down into the practitioner, and all of the metaphorical language that he was using to talk about it gave you a more of a sense that it was a very subtle visual experience as opposed to a touch experience. And so I think in my own experience, I've also, I guess, cultivated enough of a certain kind of practice to be able to understand from my practice background, both like a subtle touch, subtle body sensations interpretation, and then a subtle visual kind of interpretation of subtle energies. I guess, like, just in terms of the phenomenology, in your experience, the phenomenology of Reiki, when you talk about subtle energies, what is the phenomenological experience of that?
I think they're related, right? I think that the, for example, there's a very basic tantric meditation that's taught in, or that was taught in historic Reiki lineages, of visualizing light. And this is something that you'll see in many different, whether it's New Age or different kinds of metaphysical groups, but it's also got this longer Asian heritage, right? My memory is that when I was trained about it, we visualized it in our lower abdomen, and it's a form of cultivating the tanden, right? The lower abdominal center, danchen in Chinese, or the hara, sometimes in Japanese. And you're visualizing this waterfall of light entering the crown of your head and streaming down your torso and collecting in your lower abdomen. And then with the exhalation, gradually expanding that ball of light in your lower abdomen until it fills your body and returns to the universe. And so there becomes this contraction and expansion of light through the body. But in all of that, there's a lot of bodily sensation, right? That just because it's a visual and seen metaphor of light doesn't divorce it from the haptic felt experience aspect either. I think that goes towards how it's almost like a synesthetic experience, right? And it goes towards the metaphorical understanding that both the light and maybe even our own bodies have multiple meanings and work on different levels and intersect with each other in different ways. And so in the Reiki experience, it's a very, as I said, it's very simple. Watching a video of a Reiki session would be very boring. Someone is just usually lying down and someone else is putting their hands on them. But you can go on a real trip in that, whatever it is, hour of a treatment. Sometimes on the more seen level, lots of people experience seeing colors, seeing almost like computer-generated fractal things like you would see after taking a psychedelic drug, maybe. People have memories come up, have almost enter a state in between waking and sleep where you're like daydreaming in a vivid way. And then in a more felt perspective, sensations of heat are very common, sometimes sensations of cold as well. Sensations of tingling or pulsing are very common. And also like involuntary movements, like muscle spasms, a very frequent one. Early on, I was treating a friend of mine who had chronic sinus issues, And I would hear popping in his head, almost popcorn was going off. And sometimes mucus would just stream out the nose. And yeah, there's an older woman who I treat sometimes who's a Reiki practitioner who shakes so much during our treatments, I'm afraid she's going to fall off the table. It's like a fish flopping. And again, with merely like a very light application of the hands or just the fingertips can produce these kinds of things. And there's a lot of energy work that's being done at a distance where people will be on a Zoom call and produce like profound effects, again, with bodily sensations, visual sensations, and sometimes these kinds of difficult to explain, you know, spontaneous remissions and things like that, or people who had a chronic issue for years and all of a sudden it's gone. And so what you said before about the ontological level, I mean, it's very hard to explain any of those types of things with electromagnetic radiation because they're at a distance. Those types of effects shouldn't be manifesting. So yeah, I think, yeah, on the phenomenological level though, I do think that the visualization and the body sensations can be part of the same kind of broader phenomenon that again might have, and we might be seeing like the tips of the iceberg above the water, and there might be a lot of other stuff going on, a subliminal or who knows, some level that we are not able to access.
Yeah, and I like what you said about the synesthesia of both the visual and the tactile sensations. It certainly seems, in my case, it certainly seems that they've always come together and not two separate types of phenomena. Okay, so another question in terms of comparing between Reiki and other kinds of practices. You mentioned earlier Kundalini, and I guess both in the Indian context as well as in the Chinese context, you have the notion that energy work, you know, is not just about healing, but in some cases primarily about enlightenment or awakening or mystical experiences and so forth. And I'm wondering if that plays a role in Reiki, or is Reiki really more of limited to a healing modality?
Not in the least. From the beginning, even in its exoteric forms, the healing has been conceived of as mind and body, right? That there's this improvement of the kokoro, the shin in Japanese and Chinese, and the body. And it's not just this physical healing, right? But it's also, I think, about a kind of moral improvement that's about becoming a better person and becoming someone who is able to help others, right? I think that's really part of the Reiki ethos, is about kindness. And I think it depends how you define healing, but I think you have to define it fairly broadly,
yeah,
to include things like that.
I guess my question was more like for the recipient, right? When you're putting your hands onto somebody, in what ways are you encouraging spiritual or other kinds of development in addition to physical health?
I think a lot of it is implicit, where people come for one thing, they come for a physical ailment, and they leave transformed in ways they weren't expecting. This is something I've heard a lot from Reiki practitioner friends of mine, is that someone will come because their shoulder hurts and they leave ready to break up with their toxic boyfriend. You know, that there's like these ways where the heart is touched and people's minds and hearts come out with new perspective after receiving, like, sometimes as little as one treatment. But certainly, I think for a lot of people who receive Reiki and have those experiences, they go on to become practitioners themselves. A lot of people who are in Reiki classes have had some, you know, profound or transformative experience receiving Reiki, and that's why they want to study. But the thing you said about this kind of push towards not only what is enlightenment, right? What is awakening? You know,
well, does Reiki have its own model of awakening or enlightenment?
I think, that's what I was going to say, is that I think it's part of the more esoteric teaching of Reiki. And I actually have not myself taken the Reiki master training, I think in part because I don't feel like it's my calling to teach Reiki. But from what I understand, there is a large emphasis in that highest level of teaching on the kind of spiritual dimensions of Reiki, the mystical dimensions of Reiki. And even in the more exoteric forms, a lot of times, particularly in lineages that are either in Japan or stress Reiki's Japanese origins, they use a term called Anshin Ritsume, which it's basically like a peaceful heart and a orderly life or something like that. But people will say it as like kind of peace of mind. And it's often associated with enlightenment. Sometimes they'll use the term Satori as well for the founder on the mountaintop who had this transformative experience that then allowed him to teach others. And that in a sense, like that's what we're doing as well, right? That we as Reiki practitioners are recapitulating the experience of the founder and also working to achieve and maintain and cultivate this kind of sense of a peaceful heart and insight. And I want to get back actually to one other thing you had asked about people who receive. I think it's also, there's a lot of things that happen with Reiki where people also will have kinds of messages that they receive, psychic intuitions or things like that. And again, I think that there is a kind of opening up maybe things that you have been not allowing yourself to know or to express. These kind of repressed ideas or emotions often do bubble up to the surface. So again, that's not exactly enlightenment maybe, but it's maybe maybe mini satoris that can happen on the table. And certainly the experience of seeing light and feeling almost knocked unconscious or something like that during your treatment and then waking up feeling like a million bucks. And that's something you hear a lot as well. And I think it's something you also see in like the literature of mystical experience or something like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so that's all the positives. Now, I want to ask you about the flip side, right? Which is, you know,
That's where I thought you were going to go with that first question.
Well, yeah. Right. Well, it's an extension of my first question about Kundalini, right? Because, yeah. Kundalini is a wonderful experience for many, and for others, it leaves them completely ripped apart. So do you encounter the sorts of adverse effects with Reiki that you might get in certain cases with Kundalini or with Qigong psychosis or Qigong deviation or other kinds of energy work that all recognize the adverse events and dangers that could potentially occur with these practices? But then earlier you said that the universal source of Reiki can only be good. So I'm curious about adverse effects.
That's the party line. And you asking about this makes me realize that I really should ask more people in my communities about their experiences with meditation sickness or Qigong psychosis or the types of things that you're talking about. I do know some people when receiving a treatment or receiving an initiation do have a freak out. That is like a thing of seeing something scary, of sometimes I think people might come away with a lightheadedness that's hard for them to shake or things like that. You know, I think there are overlaps with some of those experiences. I don't feel like I have enough data to really speak to that at a deep level. I do think that some of the practices I'm aware of are really emphasize the lower abdomen, and that treating the abdomen when you have problems with the head or things like that, you don't necessarily put your hands on your head if you're having problems with your head. Make sure that your abdomen is like well charged, your kidneys, your lower abdomen, your lower back. Like you're too up here, right? You need to bring it down into the body. I think there are people who do have adverse experiences, and although I don't think they're super common, and I think maybe part of the reason they're not super common is because there's a real emphasis on treating your stomach regularly, and they might have built-in fail-safes for dealing with people who get too stuck in their heads. But again, I think people who do have predispositions for mental illness like may take similar precautions when approaching Reiki as with other forms of meditation, that it can maybe flare certain symptoms. And so it's good to make sure you're like with people who you trust, that you have people who care about you, and also that you, I think, have a teacher who is experienced and can help you with things like that. I think that there is something that's happened in the Reiki world is that I think there are some lineages and some teachers that really stress that when you receive your initiation, it's the beginning of a lifelong process of training, that you directly receive teachings from the Reiki itself, but that also you should have a lifelong connection with your teacher and that you should be able to reach out with questions and experiences. A lot of times I think the teacher will say, you need to treat yourself more, that you, if you're doing yourself treatment, this wouldn't be an issue. Like, are you treating yourself every day? That's the basic, but that you do have someone who's got your back on some sense. Mm-hmm. And then I think there's other lineages, particularly teachers maybe who teach a lot, like hundreds of students at a time, are doing like mass initiations, whether online or in person with apprentices or things like that, where you may not feel that same connection and guidance, where I think that might be like also another realm where people could maybe get into more trouble.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know too many examples of people who have had such adverse reactions with Reiki. And maybe part of that's because of like a bias in the data field that you end up hearing the success stories, and the people who have troubles maybe just tell a few close friends and feel some sort of embarrassment about it. But yeah, I have to say it is something I would like to look into more and ask more people about their experiences. But I think the practice of self-treatment seems to be a kind of built-in fail-safe for helping reduce the risk of those types of things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know if I've mentioned it on this podcast, but I think you know that I've been starting to do research on adverse effects of meditation sickness or wind disorders, as they're called in various different traditions. And this is not a scientific study, but just like from my own observations, what I've seen so far from a lot of historical documents going all the way back to really to the very beginning of the Buddhist tradition, all the way to the present, I do have the sense that the most common adverse reaction across the board to meditation practice or very intensive spiritual practice is ungroundedness. And like you said, bringing things back down into the abdomen, back down into the feet, back down into the ground, I think is sage advice for those kinds of things. But anyway, we will be revisiting this topic in a lot more detail in our third season, where we will be dedicating the whole season to a year-long exploration of the dangers of spiritual practice. So to be continued. So I wanted to ask you, though, at the beginning of our conversation, you alluded to profound or extraordinary experiences that you've had with Reiki. And I'm wondering if you can share with us one or two of the most profound or most extraordinary experiences that you yourself have had.
When I first started doing the chakra meditation, I remember I was on a hike. I think I may have been camping with some friends. I was in the mountains. And doing like and I was like, whatever, 19 or something, and doing this meditation and opening my crown chakra to the sky and just feeling this whole vortex of energy. And like, I was like in a tornado and yeah, like loss of self and feeling like this intense spiraling like sensation. That was like, I feel like, I don't remember exactly, but I feel like my body was probably like moving, like if someone had seen me sitting there. And so that was one of my really early experiences where I was like, oh, there's something going on here. I wasn't trying to do that. Like that, it felt like I had been taken by an external force.
Yeah. Let's jump on that for a sec, because okay. I'm reminded of your observation earlier that there's a conversation in the scholarly community between, are we discovering or are we constructing these experiences? Mm-hmm. And what you just hit on with the description of that experience that you had with this energy vortex, in my experience also from talking to others, it seems that these kinds of spiritual experiences, mystical experiences, I don't know how you want to define them or label them, but these kinds of experiences often have this kind of autonomous, alien, external kind of sense to them, that it's not something that's coming from me. And so I'm wondering if you can put on your scholar hat and then reflect on that distinction that you made between constructing versus discovering. Does it always feels like we're discovering it, right? It doesn't feel like it's a constructed experience, but what do you think is going on there in terms of discovering versus constructing with an experience like what you had?
I think that there are a lot of things that exist below the surface in human experience that we don't understand very well, and that there are different maps to explore different aspects of that world. And the question of the ultimate reality, I very much want to just be agnostic on that for the time being. I think that maybe, though, that discovery construction question is that if you have a particular map, you're going to discover that territory. But at the same time, it's not always the case, but that you're primed to. And that's what setting intention is in your practice. And I think a lot of times we do find what we look for, but then maybe there are unexpected things that may not be on the map as well. I think it definitely raises a number of metaphysical questions. And I think as a scholar, a lot of times I am okay leaving some of that for other people to think about. I have basically stayed fairly agnostic on a lot of these issues, I think, so far in my work. But yeah, it's definitely, I think, one of those, you asked about like the frontiers of subtle body studies. And I think that's one of the big kind of issues for the field.
And as I hear you, you're compartmentalizing your insider and outsider kind of perspectives, right? Here's my perspective as an experiencer, and then here's my perspective as a scholar. And I imagine that's taking place a lot within the field of subtle body scholarship. I'm imagining that a lot of people are attracted to that field because they've had some kind of experience on their side, and that they probably do have to navigate different kinds of discourses and expectations and norms within practitioner communities than in scholarly communities. So has that been difficult, though, to navigate both sides of that for you? And your book is a scholarly work for sure, but you do talk about your own practice experience and you talk about your dual identity in the book. And yeah, have you felt like certain perspectives are not welcome in certain communities and that you have to censor what you're saying? And
oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I did a job interview, on campus interview, where the chair of the department was grilling me about how could Reiki be real? And it was like a religious studies job. I was like, do you grill Christian scholars on angels and, you know, theology? I mean, there's definitely a kind, I think, because of both the claims, but also the position of Reiki in contemporary society, that my scholarship is probably more suspect. And also people who do new religious movements, and I think also transnational, like people working on American Buddhism have a hard time, I think, on the job market. Like, is that real Buddhism? Or questions like that. And yeah, I definitely have faced pushback professionally. I think I've played it fairly safe so far with my publications. I am like a junior scholar still, but I have been invited next year to a workshop on being a scholar practitioner or practitioner scholar. There's definitely a provocation to go deeper and to look at some of the big questions in your own practice. I think in addition to the question of ontology of energy is also the question of like appropriation and being a practice that developed in Asia and is now largely practiced by people outside of Asia. And so there is like another kind of insider-outsider aspect there as a white scholar looking at Asian practice and talking to largely white audiences of practitioners as well. As a kind of authority about Japan, there's a lot going on there too in terms of power and trying to do things honestly and at the same time raising important questions for the field. And
I mean, you said a couple times that Reiki's an Asian practice. You said that a couple times just now, but I mean, is it though? Like,
actually, no, you're totally right. I try to deconstruct that in my work and say that it's a Trans-Pacific or North Pacific practice, but it's ascribed Asian origins, right? And I think that's the same thing with postural yoga, right? Where it was developed in 1930s India, but it was very much infused with physical culture from coming out of Europe and the rhythmic gymnastics and things like that that informed the development of postural yoga. It has Indian origins that are real, but it has other origins from other places, which are often like effaced in this like thinking of yoga as Indian. And I think Reiki is similar in that regard, where it was primed for uptake by non-Japanese audiences because of its non-Japanese elements, right? That the people who were learning Reiki from Hawaii Otakata in post-war US may have had exposure to other forms of laying on of hands, other ideas about spiritual energy, other ideas about the power of changing your mind to change other aspects of your life. And all of that was in Reiki from its inception in Tokyo, including like these American currents that were being taken up there.
And then it was also heavily marketed to white America as well later, once it arrived in the US.
Yeah, it's one of the things I say in the book also about like the meditation movement, right? That the people who were trying to create lay meditation practices, which kind of became mindfulness or in different ways, that they were also influenced by ideas about experience, about democratization, about mass movements and mobilizing the middle class and the educated people and the capacity for democratized practice to create a better society, a better nation, right? This is going on all over Asia in the late 19th, early 20th century. It's not unique to Japan or Reiki.
That's one thing that I appreciated about your book is I think we know the story because other scholars have already explored and really laid out the histories of the transnational construction or the transnational origins of yoga and mindfulness and other dimensions of contemporary spirituality. But Reiki really hadn't been put on the map in the same way until you've done that. And yeah, it's really yet another piece of this overall puzzle when we think about the modern history of Asian health and healing related traditions more broadly. It's interesting how, you know, how similar Reiki is in many respects to yoga and mindfulness. And then of course, the specifics that make it different are also interesting. So thanks for your work on that, Justin. Yeah, I'm really excited about the book and hopefully it's selling well, not just among academic readers and libraries, but maybe make it a splash in the Reiki scene as well.
There's a lot more of them than there are of us. So.
Yeah, for sure. So what's coming up next? Are you pivoting off of Reiki or are you continuing to work on this topic or what can we expect to see from you in the near future?
I have a few things in the works. We did do an online conference in 2022 on the 100th anniversary of Reiki's founding, where a number of scholars from around the world and practitioner scholars and also just kind of like independent researchers, practitioners presented looking at Reiki's development. So I'm going to turn that into an edited volume this year. I'm working on a special issue for a journal that we're still putting together on transnational religious expressions between East Asia and North America. Also have an ongoing project about Buddhist nationalism, colonialism in 1930s, and also have the workshop I attended in Vienna for the subtle energies has become an edited volume that should be coming out. I don't know if it's later this year or next year, specifically looking at a number of these questions about subtle energies from a cross-cultural perspective, linking research on mesmerism, kundalini, and other forms of energy work around the world, including I have a chapter in there on Reiki and therapeutic touch. And it talks about how often the emphasis on the universality of practices like Reiki and therapeutic touch and their clinical efficacy are used to cover up some of their spiritual and religious influences. In the case of Reiki, some of the Buddhist stuff that we talked about, and in the case of therapeutic touch, a very strong theosophical influences there. And yeah, that's another thing coming up.
All right, Justin. Well, I guess there's nothing left to do other than to say goodbye, to thank you for being with us today. Thank you for your time. Thanks for this great book and for the great conversation.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Pierce and Lan. It's been a real pleasure. As I said, I love the podcast and everything y'all do. It's an honor to be able to talk about this stuff with you.
That's it for today from us at the Blue Barrel Podcast. This episode was hosted by Pierce Alguero and produced and edited by me, Lan Lee. All of our music is by Jonathan Pettit. If you're listening to us on one of our partner podcasts, make sure to catch all of our episodes on piercealguero.com or subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. You can also support us by making a donation at patreon.com/bluebarrel. Until next time, be happy and be well.